60 words.
Welcome to Anger Management. My name is Karin Pettersson.
I'm Georg Dietz.
And this week we met with Harvard economist Danny Roderick,
professor another at the Kennedy School.
Another one of my darlings.
Another present to Karin, a farewell present from Harvard.
Yes, so this is a person I've been following a long time, even before coming here this year. He's a well-known economist. He has written extensively about globalization and trade, and he comes from the world of development economics. But he said one thing this spring in class that has stuck with me.
We took his class. Political economy after the crisis.
After the crisis.
The coup of the financial elites.
I don't think he used the word coup.
No?
No. But what
it was more to that point. So.
Yeah. But what he did say was that it's interesting as a development economist to follow the what happens in the U.S. because it becomes more and more the knowledge I have, he said, becomes more and more useful when studying this country.
This failing country.
Yeah.
Yeah. So his take is more was strangely more optimistic.
Yeah.
In the conversation than ours.
Yeah, and maybe it's because he has this outlook and he's very much aware of the fact that the last decade has not just been meant crisis and the rise of populism, but also for many people in the world a rising living standards, a new middle class. India and China.
Yeah, I think what was so fascinating about the class was that. They were.
It was him,
Roberto Unger, the radical visionary, and he, the empathic pragmatist.
Yeah.
And so it was the ideal mirroring of your approach and maybe my approach. And what I found so interesting about the two of them was that how they interacted, how they sort of listened to each other. And I think that's what is sort of in the message of Roderick, that economists should be so full of themselves, should be more aware of their role as partners in a dialogue. So
yeah.
And he talked about that, about the narrator, economist as a prime storyteller in a way of our time and the way that the crisis of the lack of ideas, the crisis of vision for how to run economies these days is connected to the lack of understanding of economists as just one possible narrative.
Yeah, and he's in this interesting position where he's both, I think, critical of his own profession and maybe of the role they play in the public discourse, but also very critical of how the public and journalists and politicians, I guess, interpret and think about economics. And he says that economics is a much more complex and broad field than it's sometimes given credit for, and there will be, if you look more closely, there you can find support for, you know, diverse ideologies or ways of looking at the world. And he sees economic models more as, talks about them as fables, more as and stories, as you said, more than, you know, truths.
Yeah, and he talked in the end as as he was talking to two Europeans, he talked about Europe and about the role of Germany in rebuilding Europe and the question if they will let go of austerity, if Angela Merkel will let go of austerity, which is, I guess, a key question for the survival of the Union.
Yes.
So?
Big topics.
Yeah. Enjoy.
Professor Roderick, thank you for taking the time. I think to jump right in, sum up what we talked about in your class, Karin and I talked about, we talked about in the podcast, is basically one thing. Why did we fail? How did we fail?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's you know, it's a failure and a success at the same time. I mean, I think if we look at the last 25 years, you know, with some distance, you know, that we'll see that there were a lot of things that were very good that happened. Most importantly, of course, the fact that you had hundreds of millions of people who, you know, became significantly less poor. You know, there were countries in Asia, China, and then later India that did extremely well. And these were really, literally, know, the best times in terms of poverty reduction in any time in world economic history. So we can't simply, you know, ignore the fact that some of the poorest people in the world became significantly better off. You know, it had, you know, it wasn't all globalization, but globalization had something to do with it, especially in China, that you could get people into off the farm and into factories, and they could be producing things for world markets and sell them there. So that, so you know, there was a lot of it that actually worked, and behind that, of course, was a set of institutions that we had set up in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. The World Bank, the GATT and its successor, the WTO, the IMF, which, you know, basically, you know, maintained a system that was by and large conducive to such growth miracles and poverty reduction miracles.
So maybe we have to clarify. I just realized. So the we is the problem in this. I mean, the we is unclear. I mean, your answer is the West set up these institutions, and the West looked at globalization, and then I made the we. The we is obviously excluding 7/10 of the world population, and I think that's maybe the problem. This we is very was Western centric.
But I think even I don't think even in the West, I think it's not that we're so parochial. I think most people do care about such things. So, but the. But some, we broke some things in on the way there, and I think that's where we have failed. Now I think the foundations on which these great things did happen were, as I said, laid out at the end of the Second World War. And in fact, probably the best way to understand China's miracle is to summarize it by saying, China did so well by playing by Bretton Woods rules. Mm-hmm. That is, by playing by the rules of an earlier model of globalization, not by playing according to the hybrid globalization rules that to which we moved in the after the 1990s. Mm-hmm. So I think where we failed is we took something that was sound and was working, and an understanding where. The world economy could be a very powerful tool for prosperity and development and social progress, but it had to be at the service of those goals, that it didn't become an end in itself. And I think, sometime in the late 80s and 1990s, eventually those priorities got reversed and globalization became the end. And nations and their goals and their objectives and democracies, so to speak, had to serve the end of globalization rather than, the other way around. And I think that has created the various fissures that we are experiencing, the populism, the backlash, the discontent in the and not just in the advanced countries. I mean, I think there's a lot of discontent in the developing world as well. And I think we will see more of that as growth slows down in much of the developing world. To go back to your question, I don't think the issue is really we need to rewrite everything, that we need sort of re-engineer everything from scratch. I think most fundamentally what we need to do is return to an understanding of how the world economy fits in a world of nation states, which is an understanding from an earlier era, if you will, the Bretton Woods era, where we understood that national strategies and national social contracts and democracies came first, and we should push for globalization only to the extent that it doesn't harm those higher goals and values, and of course it'll mean we negotiate trade agreements differently, we think very differently about capital flows, we think differently about the integration process in Europe, but it's not that there was something fundamentally wrong or rigged or wicked in the system,
because a central theme of your class that George and I have been auditing this spring, and when you look at your writing, it's this trilemma of hyper-globalization, mass politics, and the national state. And you can't have all three of these, you have to choose. And I guess your story then is that in the late 80s and 90s, hyper-globalization took over as the prime project. And but I'm just curious about your... Why did that happen? Was it an ideological project, or was it the hijacking of political processes by corrupt elites? There are different models of explanations for this, and maybe we need to think about that before trying to think about how to go forward.
Yes. Well, you know, it's a great question, and I don't think we can really parse out the distinct role of interests and ideas, but I think they were both there, in the sense that we certainly had bankers and multinationals and exporters and trade negotiators and trade lawyers who were really interested in pushing forward in hyper globalization, because basically, they wanted to reduce the barriers that prevented banks from moving across national boundaries, from multinationals being able to outsource, from accessing markets, and so forth. So there was definitely an element of interest from the groups that we know were the big winners. But it wasn't just, I think, specific interest. I think, it was also that we constructed a particular narrative. There was a cognitive construct that essentially took a good story too far. And I think that was, from the vantage point of 1990, we could look back and say, look what an incredible success, the GATT has been. Mm-hmm. What an incredible success as the IMF has been. The progressive liberalization of trade and capital movements around the world. Mm-hmm. Why don't we keep going? Even if the barriers are no longer tariffs and quotas and these obstacles at the border, even though they're really about things like intellectual property rights, about consumer regulations, or about banking regulations, things that are really very much behind the border, things that are intricately entangled with national choices and democratic decision making.
So it's different from just.
It's just let's keep going,
yeah.
and. So there was a kind of a narrative that also fed the advancement of those interests. Mm-hmm. And obviously, without that narrative, without that cognitive construct, it would have been much harder for the bankers and the pharmaceutical companies and the multinationals and the financiers to push through on this. So the interests and the ideas, I think, reinforced each other.
I'm interested in that sort of moment of the lost piece, I guess, of 1989, or sort of the failure to make something of that moment. And that's something that we talked about a lot among ourselves or in the podcast, is this the role of the nation state. And if you can go back, you say you have to go back in a way to either reconstruct the system of free trade that works. Yeah. So is that an intermediate goal? So do you, in your vision, do you have a system for supranational organization that could work? Or is that the entity that you would like to work with?
Well, I do not have any particular ideological attachment to the nation state. And in fact, I thought that Europe it was potentially one region which could transcend the nation state and create a transnational democracy alongside its single market. I do think that the world is too large and too diverse to accommodate just a single global federation, but I'm agnostic as to whether in the long, unconstrained future, whether we should have, 185 states or whether we should have 25. I don't know that necessarily we can take a principled normative stand on that question. And in fact, when I, you know, the first time I wrote up the trilemma, I think it was in 2000. And in that article in 2000, I talked about some, I was asked to speculate about the future. And I said in the future, you know, basically we solve the trilemma by ending in that corner where we're combining democracy and globalization and doing away with the nation state. And I think one could envisage regional constellations of that kind sometime in the future. You know, how do we get from here to there is, of course, much more difficult. But what I do know is that if you do not have a plan to get there, simultaneously trying to integrate your economy in global markets while claiming to remain democratic and extolling the virtues of sovereignty is just, I think, a road to disaster.
So I'm interested in connecting to the question before about this moment, late 80s, early 90s, and you did say something about we, maybe that's the we that Georg started out with. Something happened in this period of time where there was a we that told a story that was maybe too good to be true, and there was kind of a loosening or maybe a disintegration of a mandate from citizens or from in within nation states. And
you're trying to avoid the word elite.
I'm trying to avoid.
Rightly so, I think it's.
But it's also, and I'm from the left. I have a background in social democracy, and I've been thinking a lot this year about what happened during the 90s and this convergence of economic policies, letting go of representing workers, letting go of representing some parts of society that then felt mm-hmm. left out and not represented, mm-hmm. and creating this political vacuum mm-hmm. that we now see. And I think that's part of the backlash that we now see. And could you talk a little bit more about this we that was created and who was left out?
Well, you know, I think my very sort of cursory summary of that would be that essentially the left not only bought into that narrative, actually became its foremost exponent. And
social democracy,
social democrats in Europe, and the Democratic Party in the United States. Now, I don't fully understand exactly why that happened, but clearly the 1980s were the time when the conservative right, the market fundamentalists, made a big assault on. Supported by the perception that, on the one hand, Keynesianism had failed, and secondly, that the welfare state was no longer could no longer be financed, and I think that left the left on the intellectually defensive position. So what happened was, I think, the left sort of bought into that narrative that Keynesianism had been defeated and the welfare state was no longer sustainable, and therefore you had to move towards sort of a much more of a market, fundamentalist system with, essentially the role of the state, the role of the left being essentially to sweeten and take the edges off the kind of
to use the famous phrase
sugarcoating
of,
sugarcoat as my good friend and colleague and co-teacher Roberto Mangabeyr Unger says, but that's very much the case. And what I find striking in this story is not that just that the left went along. In fact, the left became the promoters of the story. Of course, in Europe, it was the French socialists that pushed hard for deregulating financial markets and for capital market integration and capital account convertibility. In the United States, it was the Clinton Democrats that pushed for trade agreements and deregulating financial markets. So there was this, an incredible sort of, cognitive capture, I think would be the way that I would describe it, of, sort of the intellectuals and the thinking of the center left that pushed this agenda. And I think that in turn set the stage for the inability of the center left to provide a response.
Can I ask you two something? Because it's a revelatory moment for me now. So I mean,
just now,
moment? I just want to mark this. So no, because the left gave up obviously any belief in the power of the state as an agent. So having listened to the narrative of the right for so long, but the right gave up the state for ideological reasons also, so before that. So that was the statement, dismantling of the state. Then the left dismantled the state. So how can you intellectually, emotionally, practically fill that void? How can you, so it's everybody discarded it. Just Trump picked it up. Just Erdogan picked it up. So it's an authoritarian tool. How can you reconceive of an authoritarian tool with democratic means? Isn't it broken and gone?
I think the lesson from the story I'm really telling you is that it's not the brute force of power and interests. It's also the incredible importance of the narratives and the ideas and the cognitive maps that you put in front of people. And I think this is where the reconstruction would have to come from. So I think we should not be pessimists in the sense that, how are we going to, rewrite the system, given the power of money, given the power of finance, given the, authority of these, dictators already who have established themselves. But I think we should not overlook that, their success really relies on a narrative. If Trump was elected president, it wasn't because he came and said, I'm going to make, sort of all these people in Goldman Sachs run the economy and provide tax cuts for the rich. That's really what I'm about. He came, he won because he was able to provide a narrative about, that we had created an economic system and a trading regime that was unfair to a whole lot of people. And as an outsider, he had a credibility that Hillary Clinton
did not
have.
Which was a pretty correct narrative, actually,
and in terms of being able to give voice to those grievances, it was actually quite a valid. I don't think his remedies were the appropriate ones, but he certainly was able to give voice to those grievances in much the same way that Bernie Sanders did. I think ultimately Bernie Sanders would have moved us much more in the right direction without damaging democracy. But the point was that somebody like Hillary Clinton no longer has the credibility, even though I'm sure that Hillary Clinton's policies would have done much more. For the middle classes and the lower middle classes than Trump ever will. But the issue is, that they don't come across as credible because they, they sold us a bill of goods before, and she is the same person, and no matter what she says now.
So I have to ask you about ideas then, because you're saying that the left bought into this neoliberal economic thinking, and looking back at the history of economic thinking that we've also talked about, that you talked about in class this spring, what happened after the Great Recession almost 100 years ago was that there were new ideas coming eventually. You had Keynesianism coming as a new way of thinking about how the economy worked and as a new way of finding tools to lift people up and not just stick to these old ideas of austerity. And I'm just, what is the role of your own profession? Because I my feeling is that also on the left, also with people like myself who are trying to find new ways of thinking about the nation state, thinking about how to create equality without damaging growth, and this, you know, inclusive ideas about how to build society. But where do we get the help from your profession these days? Mm-hmm. And I know this is something that you've been writing about and mm-hmm. thinking about, because I feel that there is a lack of ideas and alternatives.
Yeah, I mean, I struggle with this. I mean, I don't think we necessarily have a lack of specific ideas, and this is a debate that we had with Roberto Roberto in class. You know, you just take inequality. You take Tony Atkinson's book on inequality and read his policy chapter. And, you know, there are 10, 15 ideas there about what to do. Some of them fairly radical. I mean, you know, that you would not have expected an economist of good standing.
Job guarantee.
To have come up with.
Like what? You know, like job like guarantee?
I would actually point to his ideas on how the government should explicitly try to influence the direction of technological change in a direction that is much more employment generating. Mm. And his idea is that, look, as long as we're in the business of financing R&D and technological innovation, it makes very little sense at times of high inequality to subsidize technologies that are going to be displacing labor, such as driverless cars. We should ensure that we're actually... And this is a, you know, this is a fairly radical idea when you think about it, that, you know, the government should actually try to influence much more explicitly the direction of innovation by ensuring that's more, you know, employment generating. You know, for a neoclassical economist, this is, and you know, sort of other, you know, ideas on taxation, on job guarantees. So it is not, and I'm giving, you know, Tony Atkinson just as an idea. We can talk about, of course, Piketty. We can talk about, Joe Stiglitz. You know, even Larry Summers, I mean, I think has long been arguing for, you know, infrastructure, which I think, you know, large amount of, you know, large infrastructure spending, which I think is a lot to be said for. I think this would be, so it is not very difficult to think of a package of ideas which are already out there, from, you know, ramp up in infrastructure to, you know, much more direct involvement of the government in industrial strategy, to progressive taxation, to you know, fiscal reflation in Europe, to higher minimum wages in the United States, that would actually, you know, make a significant impact, certainly on inequality, when you put them together. So I'm less, you know, pessimistic that there isn't, you know, that there aren't ideas, or that in fact in my own profession economists aren't engaged in generating those ideas. You know, what we seem to be lacking is you know, some kind of a master narrative that puts us together, that's sort of the equivalent of the importance of individual responsibility and opportunity, and therefore the market, and getting the government off our backs, and so that's going to put together these individual ideas in a way that sort of can be used as a political package that to construct a new coalition. It is not at all clear to me that the American, you know, middle class, the white middle class, that we are now portraying as essentially sort of racist and reactionary, you know, could not be mobilized under a different set of narrative that appeals to their economic interests and not just their inner cultural.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
sensibilities and their racial characteristics. I think there again is a political, it's a failure of the political imagination and a failure of the political center left, but not a fundamental structural obstacle.
Just to challenge what you're saying, I guess I fundamentally agree with you. You're kicking the ball back into the corner of politicians, basically, and you say that the ideas.
I hate doing that,
So I guess my question is: so we have this 20 years of market fundamentalism that we're now trying to kind of get out of, and that we now see the effects of in terms of populism, in terms of inequality, and. And all the things
we know, he wants to get out. That's the problem.
I think a lot of people want to get out of this moment. But still, the idea of the market, I think, it's so deep in the political structures, in the way we talk about politics, and in the way we talk about society. And I think what we would need is a kind of a stronger backlash to the neoclassical paradigm that was has been so influential in politics. And I guess I'm asking, I agree with you that politicians need to be more brave, and maybe we can talk about the failure of journalism and the failure of, you know, other parts of society. But I do feel that economists would need to be more self-critical of what has happened in the last 20 years and the ideas that were, you know, came out of that profession, came out of that thinking, in order for these new ideas that you talk about to really gain traction in politics as well.
No, I don't disagree about the culpability of economists, and I think you know, sometimes that's misportrayed as a financial capture, but I think of it more as a cognitive capture.
Yeah, that's,
so
it wasn't
that, you know, economists ended up being the promoters of a trade regime and a system of financial deregulation that created severe problems. It's just that, you know, they actually believed that this was a, you know, that, you know, it wasn't because they were being paid by banks or by exporters, but it was that they actually sort of ended up believing that this was the right direction in which to move, and then they ended up becoming the cheerleaders of globalization, and therefore, as a result, along with others, I think they've lost a significant amount of credibility, and that credibility needs to be rebuilt. I don't deny that at all. I'm just suggesting that economics is a broad tent, that there are in fact new ideas that are bubbling up. You know, some of the best work that's highlighting some of the downsides of globalization is coming from, you know, our top departments, you know, MIT and so you know, this stuff is indispensable, and I think there's a lot of, you know, there is some reconsideration both on the impact of trade and financial deregulation and capital liberalization in the profession. I think, you know, there's a little bit of it that's happening. I do think that we lost credibility because, you know, we did not do a very good job of presenting, in fact, our own discipline, our own profession, and what it teaches to the public, and instead, you know, essentially became one-sided cheerleaders of trade agreements. So I don't disagree with that at all. But I mean, you know, usually I'm the pessimistic one, but you two are, you know,
we're taking it to another level.
Seems so dark about where we are.
So I'll bring up the optimist in you much more sort of precisely, maybe.
Yeah, that's interesting.
With your points of, I think it's really, really interesting to think about globalization as a cognitive model, as a narrative, that how you approach the world and all the many worlds. And this is, I think, why the we in the beginning is such an essential problem. There is no we. So and actually, we talk about economics, but we talk about the world in the 21st century here. So how do you see others? How do you listen to others? And that's sort of my takeaway from the class and from other classes here is you have to be precise about the places. You have to be knowing which are the countries that you talk about, and so that's what Roberto Unger would call Fordist method. Is the other way. You have a uniform vision for the world. You have one strategy, which is sort of the IMF strategy of austerity and lowering taxes and all that stuff, and then creating business friendly environments. So, but you talk very precisely, I think, about sort of, maybe you can elaborate on that, sort of the multitude of solutions, or the precision of going to a country and really understanding what's the place there. I think that's really inspiring.
So I think you're right that I think it's very important to be very careful about who the we is. And I think one of the mistakes that, we intellectuals have made is to buy in into this notion of global citizenship. You'll remember the outcry when Theresa May said, I think it was at the Conservative Party Congress at the end of last year, that if you say you're a global citizen, you're a citizen of nowhere, and all the in polite company, this became like a horror that Theresa May was saying something that was so backward and regressive, and was pushing us back into sort of our little countries. But when you think about it, she's actually 100% right that there is no such thing as a global citizenship. It doesn't make sense even as a metaphor. That citizenship is something that has to do with being part of a political system, being part of a political community. Now, who are we, the so-called global citizens, who are we a citizen of? I mean, we're basically just end up, we're just talking to each other. And then we feel we're, are discharging our obligations to citizenship by talking to other people who look like we, who travel in this, global, international network, and we have the same high-minded views about how we're all in the same boat, and it's one planet, and we need to look at, take care of the poor while we're expanding, economic opportunities for everyone and so forth. But the we is really defined by the boundaries of existing political communities. And the boundaries of existing political communities today are the nation states. So the we is the nation state. So this is what I really believe in very strongly. If we do what's best for our own country, whatever country we're a citizen of, if we do the best for our country, and our country works well, and we have properly functioning governance at the national level, forget global governance. If we have properly functioning governments at the national level, we will have a much better functioning global economy. We will have a much healthier globalization that we can sustain. So the way to really achieve a lot of the ends that we want is really by doing better as we national citizens, not some abstract global citizens. And I think that is the essential logic that we have to return to, that we have neglected because of this sort of high-minded cosmopolitan sense of cosmopolitanism.
Isn't the problem?
Go ahead.
In a way that sort of there are so many the nations which are in the 21st century and nations which are still in the 19th century, in a way. And it all happens at the same time. And the problem is, so from a European perspective, I think it's an ideological, and I think you're right about sort of the failures of imagination and that, so that you wanted a certain story to be true, so you had to have the all-encompassing, the big European Union. I remember the discussion about sort of the core union or the larger union. It was sort of totally, everybody was agreeing that this is a very, very, everybody seemed to be agreeing from the middle that you have to be the larger union is the bigger, better solution, whereas the smaller union might have made sense because those are countries on the same level and the same time, living at the same time. So I'm wondering how this could happen on a global scale if you have sort of emerging democracies or struggling democracies and you have drifting countries like Turkey or now the United States, which sort of drift out, and then you have people who want, countries who want to play by the rules, namely Sweden. Germany or others. So if it's on Germany, not it's not playing by the rules. We can talk. We should talk about that. So the destruction of Europe by Germany. So how can you come up with the system that manages of those different time trajectories?
Well, precisely by not trying to squeeze them into a common set of rules. I mean, I think that's the point. There are some truly global problems like climate change or health pandemics where you really need a lot of global cooperation to get action. Even then, I think that much of the action on global climate will be achieved by individual countries or states progressing despite the absence of global agreements. And I think what you see in California, what you see in China in terms of what they're doing, you can see that that even there you can have a significant amount of action without global agreements. But if we look at, leave truly global public goods aside, like the global climate or the global health system, most of the economic problems don't have the nature of global public goods. That is that, in order to provide them, you don't need tremendous amount of global coordination and global cooperation. After all, things like free trade, free capital mobility, sound finance, good growth programs, those are good for individual countries on their own. It's not for the benefit of other countries that I should have a fairly open economy. It's for my own benefit. It's not for other countries' benefit that I should have immigrants. It's for my own benefit. It's not for other countries' benefit that I should have sound financial regulation. It's for my own benefit. So if countries are doing what's good for themselves in the first place, in other words, acting purely out of national interest and not out of cosmopolitanism, they will end up doing the things that are right for other countries too, by and large. And I think, and that's the essential truth. And if they are not, so if you have countries, that are, either regimes that are ruining their economy, if you're regimes that are driving their countries into authoritarianism, there is very little that the rest of the world can do to actually change that. There is something they can do. There's the do no harm principle. You don't sell arms to cruel authoritarian regimes that are repressing the rights of the people. You don't necessarily provide them, the same access to markets that you do to other democratic countries. But you do it out of principle. You do it out of, we don't want to be assisting the hand that's murdering people or repressing people. You don't do it out of, expectation that that's really going to necessarily change how they behave. So those are, the two key principles. If you do what's right for you, you'll also serve a global cause. And secondly, if there are countries that are, falling, through these economic or political syndromes, there's very little that the rest of the world can do other than follow the principle of do no harm. That by itself, by the way, would require a lot of change. The principle of do no harm.
Yeah, you would need institutions to enforce that, right?
Well, not necessarily global. I think democracies have a responsibility to their own values, to their own interests. Not to be to provide, to take a clear example, doing arms deals worth of $100 billion dollars with a dictatorship like Saudi Arabia. That's a failure. Sweden and
Germany,
which has its arms industry, and of course Germany. So I think all democracies are culpable there, but the argument there has got to be won on the national level. It's got to be the Swedes and the Germans and the Americans who are should be able to organize and tell their governments this is not consistent with our own values. It's the failure of our own governance mechanism. It's not some failure of lack of global cooperation or global governance that's causing this.
So I'm hearing a strong argument for the existence of agency on the national level. And it's interesting, I think, because I guess one residual or one thing that the 90s left us with is this idea that the nation state is lax in agency because of globalization and global capital flows that will just, you know, companies will just leave you. If you have too high taxes, they will just go somewhere else. And this argument, I think, is strong. This idea is still very strong, for example, where I come from in Sweden, that there's this kind of lack of confidence in the idea that we can actually, you know, build something very different from, or very different, but that we can have our own political project. There is this idea of mainstreaming still. And could you?
Well, I think, you know, there's. I think it's an idea that's. I think it's overstated.
Yeah.
I think the existence of Sweden is an example.
Yes, I agree with that.
So it's not like, you know, Sweden has turned into Britain or the United States in the last 20 years. But
really,
yes, that argument is made, and you know, and Sweden did have to lower its, you know, top tax rates significantly,
did it have to, or did we just believe that we have to?
I think you had to. Probably it had gone too far. I mean, I think, you know, it's I'd like the argument for reducing, for example, top tax rates to be based not on, you know, if we don't do that, people will leave or capital will leave, but instead on the basis of, you know, that this is, you know, this is hindering entrepreneurship and economic opportunity too much. So you sort of make the argument on its merits rather than on, you know, this is what globalization requires us to do.
I think because you don't believe that's true, or do you think it's just a bad argument?
I believe that's only half true. I say, to the extent that it's not true, because after all, people do want to go live in Sweden, because I think, you know, Sweden provides significant amount of public goods because of you know, being able to tax its tax stake being so high, and that's why people do go live in Sweden. So in other words, you know, the high taxes are compensated by the high quality public institutions and high quality of public goods that are provided, and that balances out. But there is the other 50% that is true, which is that, you know, in a world of capital mobility, sometimes it is difficult to tax your mobile professionals and your capital, and that there is a race to the bottom, which makes leave all countries worse off, and to the extent that, you know, that, you know, there is such a problem, I think countries should interfere. They should have the self confidence to say, no, this is the part of globalization that I do not like. And I think smaller countries, of course, have a harder time, because then the smaller countries will need to coordinate with other countries to find a solution to tax havens. But, you know, I think there, you know, some of the larger rich countries can move. No country, I mean, no company can afford not do business in the United States. If the U.S. were able to say, you know, if you don't abide by my tax rules and create a shell company somewhere else to evade taxes, then you don't have access to my market. No company will accept that and take the, you know, not pay taxes. You know, if the EU or even, you know, significant members of the EU could collectively agree on that, once again, I think would be extremely powerful.
It's a Piketty argument.
Yes. So I'm saying two things. I'm saying that on a lot of issues, I think we exaggerate the constraint that globalization places on the nation state. But I also say that, yes, I mean, the constraints have increased, you know, and that's part of the problem with the global system that we have currently, is that it has narrowed the scope for democratic decision-making. It has narrowed the scope for difference, for Sweden to decide how it wants to be Sweden. And that we should not allow.
Could we go back to the EU?
You don't want to talk about Sweden anymore.
For a moment, I want to talk about Karin's shouting match with Darren Acemoglu the other day, where he said, well, she's the last social democrat. And
Merkel.
And you said, no. And so that moment of reckoning with sort of the difference Merkel inside sort of politics and sort of towards refugees and the European sort of the austerity measures that sort of are potentially leading to disintegration of Europe. Could you maybe from your perspective, and that goes back to the failure of economists maybe, or to come up with a certain clear view of what's happening, could you explain to me why, from your perspective, why German economists or politicians had such a difficult time to let go of that very moralistic argument, and what are yeah. and were the consequences of Germany's actions within Europe?
Yeah, I mean, I think again, it's a confluence of ideas and interests. I mean, I think sometimes, you know, the German view is presented as being the result of, you know, the residue of the experience with hyperinflation in the interwar period, and therefore the excessive focus on monetary stability and on fiscal conservatism. And that, you know, that has colored sort of, you know, German views on economic policy, that, you know, this ultra-Orthodox, you know, perspective on the macroeconomy that has never bought into Keynesianism and so forth. So I think there's an element of that, but it's not the only thing. I think it's also the fact that, you know, Germany found itself at the time of the crisis in a structurally very strong position as the creditor nation that already had full employment and was doing well in terms of economic performance, and therefore, you know, frankly, it wasn't exactly against its interests to pursue austerity policies for Europe, because the cost would be borne by others. And to the extent that it ensured that money would be coming back to the banks, it would, it would serve the interests of the of Germany as a creditor
so
nation.
How doesn't that contradict your hopeful statement about the nation states working for the interests and then so ultimately for greater good?
So no. I mean, I think the problem with Europe is that, you know, up until the crisis, you know, the perception was that it was a union. Mm-hmm. And then once the crisis comes, then, you know, from the perspective of Germany, it became, those lazy Greeks and those profligate, Greek government, you know, why should we be, you know, bailing them out? Mm. Whereas if you had carried out the logic of the union, it would have been a story about interdependence. It was that we created this union, you know, we created a system where a lot of German banks lent to Greece. The problem was as much us overlending as it was the Greeks overborrowing, and that would have been the logic of the union. And then we look at it as a collective problem, we solve our collective interests. So that's precisely the problem of Europe, that, you know, it's not having decided, or having decided at some point until the crisis strikes, as thinking about like as a union. But once the crisis strikes, the national interest comes back again. And of course, that's much more dangerous, because if the national interest was going to prevail, then capital markets would have ensured that Greece would not have gotten so much money, you know, and people would have protected themselves. Mm. And therefore, you would not have had the kind of crisis that you had. But I do blame Merkel and the German government for having resorted back to the logic of national interest and the kind of a morality play thrifty Germans versus profligate Greeks, which in fact in turn fed into a kind of re-highlighting of national interest and made, I think, the building of a political community that much harder.
And can Macron and Merkel sort it out? Is there a new beginning for?
I don't know. I'd hope so. I mean, I think what Germany doesn't seem to realize is that this line that, you know, you do your structural reforms, and if they work, and then, you know, then we'll give you some fiscal space, is got it exactly backwards. Now, you know, because structural reform, when it works, is going to produce some results in the medium term. What Macron needs is early results. It needs, you know, early gains on reducing unemployment. And if he's just going to have to rely on structural reform, it's just going to make him less popular over time. And you know, he will prove another Hollande. So I can understand the German view that, oh, if we just give them fiscal space, they'll just use it, but not do the structural reforms. You know, but then you have to decide, okay, you know, if you do not trust your main partners in the European project, right? We're not talking about Greece anymore. We're talking about now about France. Mm. If you're not going to trust your main partner in the European project, you know, forget it. And this is, frankly, it's the last chance. I mean, you know, I don't think it's going to, because if Macron fails, you're not going to get anybody, you know, more willing to an eventual European solution.
So, as a last question, it's interesting that you accused us earlier in the podcast to be gloomy and pessimistic.
Diagnosed, and maybe not accused.
I don't mind being optimistic for a change.
No, I don't know if this description of the, you know, the future of German-French relationships or the prognosis is very optimistic. But on the optimistic note, what's the way out of this trilemma then for? And I'm speaking now of the West, of Europe and the U.S. What is the positive way of thinking about the, say, the next 5 years? What could happen?
Well, I think, you know, let me leave aside Europe for a second, but for the United States and other countries who are not members of the European Union, I think it's going to be a matter of rebalancing our priorities, and I think we need to self-consciously and unembarrassedly put sort of national renewal first. And for reasons that I explained before, you know, this is not an anti-globalist, it's not a parochial, it's not a, you know, nativist, xenophobic view. It's one that says that if you want a healthy global economy, you have to start with healthy national economies, and that can only be done by reimagining and renegotiating the domestic social contract, and that's going to require putting national democracies first and foremost. And so that means, fundamentally, let's think about, you know, globalization and its rules again as a means to that end rather than an end in itself. So from that perspective, I don't mind at all if we put trade agreements in the back burner for the time being while we're engaged in a real project of national renewal, not a fake one, as in the case of Donald Trump. And I think in the case of Europe, I think the choice is there. You know, maybe Macron and Merkel will make it work. They'll understand, okay, this is a second window of opportunity. The first one was right after the crisis. We blew it. Now we have a new president. There'll be a German election soon. There'll be a new mandate. And let's go and show some real leadership and push us. And let's pull our publics, because after all, Europe is always, you know, I guess to denigrate it, you could say it's an elite project. But, you know, to actually, you know, in the more neutral terms, it was always the elites, the political mainstream, you know, essentially pulling their publics along on this European project, for which there wasn't a lot of popular enthusiasm. But the politicians played a huge role in bringing this along. Now we need the equivalent of that in the social sphere, in the fiscal sphere, in the political sphere that we already had in the economic sphere in the 1980s. And maybe if that happens, you know, Europe can pull through to a different corner of this trilemma where they're essentially building a European political community and transnationalizing democracy. With much significant roles for the nation state in Europe.
So with that call to arms for Angela Merkel, thank you so much, Danny Roderick, for this conversation.
Great to talk to you.
Thank you.